Hey, this is Gavin Wood, bringing Countdown back to 6 o'clock Sunday night. I'll recap the national top 10 from days gone by.
And you can dance.
And chat exclusively with the big names from the Countdown days. Glenn Shorrock. Kate Soprano. Ivor Davies from Ice House. And it all starts with Daryl Braithwaite.
It was pandemonium. You didn't really know how it all came together or whatever, but that ABC, they did it very, very well.
Sunday night from 6 on Gold 104.3, WSFM, the 80s on iHeartRadio, on Classic Hits 4KQ and 96FM. Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast, proudly brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Grant Rule was the executive producer of Countdown, and I had the pleasure of sitting down to reminisce with him. He reveals so many fun, crazy stories that happen on the set and behind the scenes, and even how Molly was hired for the gig. Now, this is a very special two-part podcast, and trust me, you'll love it. Take a listen. Thanks always to our supportive sponsors, Tobin Brothers and White Glove Movers.
Hi there, Grant Rule here, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast.
Well, it gives me great pleasure in this podcast to speak to my boss of Countdown, Grant Rule.
Gavin.
You've still got it.
Thank you.
Now, you were the executive producer of Countdown.
Well, yes, I started off as a producer and director about 77. Right. Did a few other things in between, and I think I became executive producer around about 81, 2, right, and then saw it through to its final demise.
Well, it wasn't a demise. It was a sad ending.
Yeah, well, so.
from all the Countdown fans, it really
an
was.
An epic journey.
Epic journey, it was. Yeah. It was a great journey.
And a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. But we all have fond memories. Now, Grant, just tell me the management hierarchy in the Countdown chain. There was Michael Shrimpton, right?
Yes, originally it was Michael Shrimpton, together with Robbie Weeks. Now, Michael was an ABC a producer from Perth. And he was promoted to come to Victoria to take over the then fledgling entertainment department. Right. Prior to him, it was a fantastically creative fellow called Lee Spence, who would do all those variety shows like Perryman on Parade or Kamal or all these high-end variety shows. And, of course, Michael came over to refocus the organisation in Victoria, and it grew from there. So he, together with Robbie Weeks, an old director of mine when we were all kids on television at Channel O in those days, and he had joined the ABC, and then together with Molly, they created basically what the format of Countdown. I joined the show exactly about 100 shows in. My very first show as a standby. In other words, I'd been appointed as a producer-director to take over from a fellow named Paul Drain. Now, Paul Drain, in my view, together with Robbie Weeks, created the frenetic, amazing thing that became Countdown on air. I'm not talking about the behind-the-scenes stuff. But Paul was the producer-director, and I was on standby. And, of course, it was the 100th show, and it just evolved into this unique and amazing, let's be honest, brawl.
Well, I'll tell you how Molly got hired, because this story has been told many times. And Michael Shrimpton and Robbie Weeks were sitting in the pub. It's probably the Elston Wick, because that's where we all used to gravitate to. And Molly's arrived, driven through the bottle shop, but the front wheel went up on the gutter, and all of that. And he's and he's raced out of the car, frantic and everything like that. And then I don't know whether it was Michael or Robbie said, "There's our host."
I think it was Robbie.
It was Robbie. Yeah, there's our host. And it was, what a great choice, though.
Oddly enough, they didn't hire him as a host. He was never a host officially. He was the talent coordinator, which is a bit strange, given that he's, from my view, his creative input and his frenetic, you know, contribution to the program every week. You know, it was his show in that sense. He owned its creative directions just by the sense of his, you know, his personality and his, you know, his attack on life. You know, he was amazing. You know, Robbie and Michael played, they were servants of the ABC. In fact, we all were.
Yeah.
And so you had this contrast immediately of this freewheeling commercial beast and, of course, these two guys who were representing the ABC, which is a very staid organisation in those days.
I was just about to say, who would Michael Shrimpton be answerable to after, you know, a really outrageous Countdown goes to air on the Sunday night? What happens Monday morning in the office?
There was a director of entertainment who was based in Sydney. And of course, then there was the director of television who, oddly enough, was based in the city. It was very sort of bookshelves and
yeah.
and you know, an old-fashioned sort of building, and that's where the mayor, that's where the hierarchy lived. And in those days, the ABC were, they all operated independently. Television operated independently of the of radio, of concerts, of all the other things that they do, and so on. So it was this very diverse range of, you know,
officers and people.
Yeah, that made up this amazing thing in those days called the ABC. So Michael was, I guess, responsible. But there was a, it was well known by the time I got on board. I mean, I used to witness the comings and goings of Countdown. You know, I was directing a show called Bellbird, and I was a very young yeah. kid, and it was an original soapy. And you know, all we see is on weekends this manic behaviour going on, kids running amok and security guards and yeah. bands coming and going. And but I've got to say, it gave everyone a tremendous vibe, you know, sort of. We're all secretly jealous of them because they were just so creative. So when I was purloined into the job, and I say purloined because I was doing my very best to stay away from rock and roll, given my experiences of the 60s and Molly, and I was hiding away in drama, and of course we're reacquainted, and somehow or other I was told, because I knew Ian, and because I'd done television, and because I did rock and roll television, and because these becauses kept, you know, you're perfectly right for the job. And I said, yes, but I'd rather be doing drama. They said, no, you're doing this. But I can't complain, it was a fantastic journey.
Let's go right back, because you covered it, the very early days of Grant Rule. Where did you grow up?
Well, I in a number of places.
Right.
The family home is South Yarra. I bought it in Brighton, and we were living at the time in New Guinea. And so what was happening was there was no secondary education in New Guinea in those days.
Hmm.
And so I came to boarding school in Melbourne. So I basically grew up between those areas.
Right.
And
quite unique, really, when you think about it.
It's not your traditional way
no.
of... No. That nuclear family thing was a little bit loose for me.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But that's... And oddly enough, I ran into Ian quite... Well, I was quite a young man, you know, like... Mm. I'd visited some friends up in Quambatook, and they were farmers, fellow boarders.
Yeah.
So on a school holiday, rather than go back to New Guinea at the time, I went to... joined them up at their place. Now, up there, Molly's at the time...
At Kyabram.
Now, he's, I think he's, but he was staying with his grandmother, I believe,
oh,
in Quambatook.
Yes.
And when
yes.
I first did Commotion Show with him in the early 60s, we figured we knew each other. We couldn't quite work it out. And in retrospect, we worked out that it was probably Quambatook.
Right.
So
it was meant to be.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, here we are.
So it was very fashionable back in, when was Commotion on, 1965?
Yeah, 4, 5, 6.
Around there. And, of course, you know, we were getting the Carnaby Street fashions and all the English music coming out and everything like that. And then you cut to this brand-new show called Commotion, where there's all these good-looking people dressed to the nines with the best suits on and the whole thing. I mean, you guys were figureheads, really, in the fashion industry when you think about it.
It was all casting. It's a bit like a reality show. It's all in the casting, you know. So, and what the producer, David Joseph, said was, well, Grant, you're going to do sultry mummy things, and Alex Rappel's going to do rugged stuff, and Leon Cameron. Eventually Tony came on and did Carnaby, as it were.
Tony Healy.
Tony Healy. Yeah. And then eventually Molly. But we were all on it originally, and then for some reason we all left. We were talked into leaving because the producer had a run-in with Channel O at the time.
Okay.
And then, of course, Molly was a journalist, and he joined Commotion as a performer, and
right.
and Tony Healy and the whole bunch of them, Keith Miller and so on, they became the kids, but we left to become the Commotion Rebels.
So after Commotion, you ended up on Uptight.
Yeah, I went on my way, and I think I found a job.
A real job?
A real job, because I wasn't really a performer, and I sort of knew it.
Mm.
And so, and then I got a phone call to come in and do the show, and turned out to be the fantastic Roster Wiley, you know, and he hosted 4 hours live to air unrehearsed, and everyone seemed to have a role, but I certainly know I didn't.
So what happened after you left?
Well, I got a job in the police department.
Really?
Yeah. It was basically transferring cars. It was the, what is it called?
The RTA or whatever.
Yeah, it's one of those places. Anyway, I just went there, and I thought, well, if I'm going to, it's time to grow up and I should get it. And what do I like? Yeah. And I realised I love television, but not the performing side.
Gotcha.
And I remember watching, in those days, Robbie Weeks used to direct us in those early shows at Channel O before the whole countdown thing.
Mm.
And, I thought, oh, I'd love to do that because I used to watch him. So the only place that was offering, real opportunity to expand your knowledge, there was Crawford's and the other great production houses, a limited number. And then the stations, of course, were in production, but they were very closed shop at the time. It was the ABC was the only place. And, you know, they had religious departments, sporting departments, concert departments, radio. It had all these, you know, marvellous opportunities. So I joined in there and I became a driver.
Mm. A driver for the ABC?
Yes, a mailroom in the mailroom.
That's something I never knew about Grant Rule. Driving in the mailroom.
Yes, but what you did do was learn to know who everybody. You learned very quickly who were the power players.
You basically started at the bottom.
Oh, yeah.
Good on you.
Oh, with the advantage of being on telly. So by the time I got into telly production, the kids were having their first beer, I guess, you know, whereas for me, I'd sort of been there and done that. So I was able to advance perhaps a little quicker than the others.
Well, can you remember the first show you directed?
Normally you went into the pool and then you did news and current affairs and all that.
Right.
And I just went straight into Bellbird. I was an assistant director and been there a few months. And then one of the directors went, he became ill. And I'd been doing a little bit of work on him, and the directors, we were the assistant directors, you know, we did, you know, directed the B crew and did extra peripheral shooting, you know, like car chases and stuff. And then he went home sick, so I was able to take over the show and to direct that particular episode. And so I started in drama. About a year into that, the head of television in Melbourne called me up and said, look, you know, you're used to us just doing drama. You've got to be. So they shoved me back into sport and I did current affairs shows and all the real stuff, the real meat that enables you to gather your skill base, you know. So
what a journey, though.
It was unusual at the time.
Yeah. Oh, well done. That's something I didn't know about you.
Yeah, so they had this thing about young audiences and we're aiming this show at 10 to 17-year-olds. And yet Molly and I had come from commercial television, and I used to say 10 to 17-year-olds. I'm not quite sure how you'd do that. But anyway, I guess it was younger pop. We don't worry about ratings. And I'm going, okay. So we'd end up in dispute with senior management when we would play a song that was older. And by that, I appealed to an older audience.
Like a Kenny or a Dolly song or something like that.
Well, not only that, but just something that was slightly more, you know, risque a little bit. There'd be a reaction, you know, from management saying, oh, no, you know, and we could never quite come to grips. And I used to tell Ian, look, we'll say yes to them. We'll just do what we want.
Yeah.
So I used to play that game. And I'd be hauled up regularly. What are you doing? You're starting to rate 22 and there are far too many older people in the audience. So we're always a bit nonplussed.
Well, see, those ratings, that was Mum and Dad and the kids sitting down watching Countdown. That was the beauty of Countdown, because the kids would explain Boy George to Mum and Dad.
Yeah. And I guess it was, yeah.
It was a family. It was a family thing. It really was. Because you get that feedback when you go like all over Australia. The beauty of the ABC, of course, it went all over Australia.
Yeah, we used to tell those lies, I remember, live through 400 stations. A lot of them were transmitters.
Yeah, but it's true, though.
But anyway, it was a bit of a call to arms. And I guess for the average person, we had a lot of feedback from ad agencies and things about the show. And I guess because the ABC just let us loose and we were able to do things at the time which were unusual, you know, the ad agencies, they were, you know, everyone who wanted to know about pop or rock and roll music, in an hour, you know, you could get it because it was the only show at the time.
Now,
I'm not dismissing Sounds and those other great shows, but I'm just saying it was like this call to arms, you know, appointment viewing. Mm. So you get your hour, you get this ratings boost nationally, and then we'd all get on with it.
Yeah.
But I guess that was the ABC, the beauty of the ABC. But they were extraordinarily kind to us, the management.
Yeah.
We were able to do some, you know, Goat Island, Midnight Oil, Oils and Water, Goat Island, Oz for Africa.
Oh, yeah.
Ending up Elton John and the MSO. I mean, come on. I was associated with those shows and I used to sit there thinking, how on earth is a group of serious-minded ladies and gentlemen approving this? It was just extraordinary. We were very blessed.
Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934, Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi there, Grant Rule here, and you're listening to Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast.
Thank God for Ted Emery.
Yeah, go Teddy.
Hey? he had the nous to put those countdown reels in the boot of his car.
Yeah, I know.
Because he knew that they were going to wipe them.
I know, yeah. He grabbed his shows first, I noticed.
Oh,
no,
did
no,
he?
No, I'm joking.
Oh, that's funny.
No, I remember once sitting in the office, and I'd been to was a very young person. The ABC, in their wisdom, decided to grab a whole bunch of young people, give them travel allowance, and shove them in Sydney to produce a director course. Oh, and it was an internal thing they did, and it was quite serious business.
Yeah.
But the whole, it was based in above a Coles supermarket, the studio, in King's Cross.
Oh, no.
So this is the 70s King's Cross.
Oh,
it's not
no.
the King's Cross.
Oh, no.
And so you've got this couple hundred kids, well, no, 20 or 30 kids running amok on travel allowance.
Yes.
Running amok in Sydney. It was a great experience. But during that, it was the first time, I think, I could be corrected here, a fellow named David Stevens, who was a writer-director, I think he did Alice, that's mini-series Alice.
Yeah.
It was an absolute smash hit. He was a hero of all of us, you know, and I was in drama at the time, before I started Countdown. And he sort of said, he gave us a parting comment at the end of the course, and he said, if you don't ask, you'll never know. Anyway, so you now come years later, and I'm sitting in the Countdown office. At that stage, Teddy was my assistant. He ended up becoming the same as me, a producer-director, but he was working directly to me at the time, saving my butt, you know.
Yeah.
And I was working on the show that weekend, and I'd read a recent article about John Gorton. And John Gorton was a politician, the ex-Prime Minister of Australia, who I sort of had in my mind was a silly old coot. In actual fact, he was a war hero, and he had a battered face, his plane crashed, he was a genuine war hero. And he was...
The Prime Minister of the day.
And he became Prime Minister. And then he voted himself out of office, which sort of suited him, like he decided there was a bit of controversy. And so he stopped being Prime Minister, and someone else took over, and he was now retired at the time by a few weeks when I think we got to him.
Okay.
Anyway, I was sitting there thinking, I'm looking at this article about David Stevens' comments, if you don't ask, you'll never know. And I thought, it would be nice to have a politician on the show, you know, which is a kid's show. I said to Teddy, it's great having an idea, but someone has to actually action. I said to Teddy, why don't you give Johnny Gorton a ring and see if he'll come on the program? He goes, what, really? And I go, yeah, you know, and dismissed it and went on with my getting the show organised.
Yeah.
Anyway, an hour later, he says, he's on the phone. I go, who's on the phone? He says, the old guy. I go, what old guy? He said, well, it's his office. He wants to know how much. I said, what?
How much?
To this day, I don't believe they wanted to know how much. I think it was Teddy.
Yeah.
He's got the personal line. It's the ex-Prime Minister's assistant.
Yeah.
Ex-Prime Minister by a few weeks or months or something. He goes, yeah, he wants $100. He says, you're going to do it. I said, oh, great. So we all end up, I couldn't believe it, you know, Teddy did the groundwork. So we end up going to the 3LO radio station. It was up in the legal precinct of Melbourne at the time.
Right.
And down comes John Gorton with his minders, and there's a bit of press hanging around, and they see Ted Emery and Grant Rule, and they're going, what's going on here? These reprobates from Countdown.
Yeah.
And so they all start trying to find out what's going on. But John Gorton said, you ready? So we all, he said, what's you got in mind? And we took him up to Spring Street and did that opening where I put a bunch of extras together and they all ran. Mr. Gorton, and he said, not now. Mr. Prime Minister, not now. I've got to get home to watch Countdown and, throw it away.
A famous piece of television.
No, well, it's not famous. But
it is. But
that's what we were allowed to do, these things, all because of Teddy and his bullshit.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He's fantastic. You know? Anyway, the irony of the story is that at the end of this little thing, the Prime said, well, what's next? And we're going, sure, well, there's nothing next. You know, we just thought, well, just a silly opening, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, right, yes, the plan is, sir, we're going to drive around Melbourne and show off the city and interview on the way, you know. And so we travel around for the next hour and a half, no film in the camera, bullshitting our way through an interview that didn't exist.
Oh, that's outrageous.
But good old Teddy, you know, like
he actually got
it.
He got the footage he wanted, and that was it.
Yeah, I got what I was doing, and he set it up. I just couldn't believe it. But he went on to have this fantastic career, you know.
Well, Kath and Kim and...
So I think getting back to that, you know, there's a whole range of people who contributed to the show. But like I said, it was Paul Drain and Robbie Weeks who sort of...
Yeah.
Robbie initially, and then Paul with his unbelievable inventiveness. They really gave it that energy that we all inherited and were able to build on or detract from as time went on. At the end of the day, you know, coming back to Molly, he... you know, it was his show, you know. And I when I took it over as the executive producer, I sort of stopped the pretense. You know, they kept calling him the talent coordinator. And I said, and one of the attractions of the show that they came up originally was with that the band members would host the program.
Host the show, yeah.
And I said, we got to a certain point, That's fantastic, except if a band creates an image and you have, you know, these enormous time and expense put into creating an image, and then the guy, the lead singer, comes on and he doesn't sound right, or he's...
G'day, welcome to
Countdown. Well, not so much that, but his personality mightn't want what you need.
Sure.
You sort of, it's potentially detrimental to their sales.
Absolutely.
Because you're breaking down. And it's the same with, I think I altered the policy. I had a lot of problems doing it, but there was a problem that everyone had to sing, a position that everyone had to sing live.
Mm.
But the problem in a television studio, despite the best efforts of that genius Ian Battersby, who was on audio, it didn't always end up sounding like the record. And I'm not sure that... So in my mind, you know, for the sake of the show and the audience and the relationship between the talent and the audience, was that if they don't sound like the record, you know, so we started to allow miming.
You know,
there's two schools of thoughts as to whether or not that's good or not. Well, my view was, look, hey, they're... fans love them, and you know, the fact that their appearing's really enough, you know.
Yeah.
But then there's counter arguments legitimate on the other side.
Well, Daryl Braithwaite said on his podcast, he said it was hard for me. He said because by the time How's That came, you know, I'd been singing it in the clubs, out there in all around Australia, and then putting a little bit extra here, a little bit extra there, and then all of a sudden you go back into the Countdown studio, you've got to remember what the hit was like, and you got to put your lips on the right words and all that. And he said it just blows your head off.
Yeah, but there was no rule that said you couldn't sing live. I just said for those who, you know, that we're always up front. It's great to say we want you to do it live.
Mm.
But if we can't match what they're selling or what they are
coming
on to do, which is, from their point of view, promote their latest record,
it
doesn't sound right. So on radio you've got another version, which is the real one, and then you've got this other.
Yeah.
Now, it wasn't a bad version. Don't misunderstand me, because Ian Battersby, as I say, and those audio guys were fantastic.
Yeah.
But it really did struggle. So, we you know, there's a few moments and that we changed the direction of the program. But I always said at the time, given the bands, let's just cut to the chase. Molly's really hosting. We can dress it up as all these other things.
And of course.
We stopped a lot of that early. But we were now talking, you know, I picked up in 77 and I'm now talking 79, 80. So,
do you remember that show with the Ramones?
I was up doing Farnham and Byrne at the time.
Oh, were you? Oh, well, Joey, you know, these are punk guys with hair right down to their nose, you know.
Yeah.
And the dress rehearsal was horrible because Joe would say, man, I can't read the cue cards. And then we're all going, oh, no, this is going to be a bloody disaster. Right? So come the show, and we're all on tenterhooks, right?
Yeah.
You know, and they're doing Rock and Roll High School at the beginning of the show, and I've gone to introduce him, and I was so pent up, and I said, and here's the Maroons. And no one picked it.
Yeah. Well, you know, all that screaming, it's all just Rock and Roll.
I know. Molly's still on my tail for that.
Is he really?
Oh, yeah. He rang me in L.A. and he said, I've forgiven you. And I said, what? He said, I've forgiven you. I said, what? It was 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, about what? He said, the Rock Awards. I said, what about the Rock Awards? I said, yeah, there's 3 o'clock in the morning. What? Click.
No.
So
I've been having, I think the quote was, I say I've been having heavy sex in Australia.
Yeah.
And Molly sort of completely thrown through to you. And over to you, Gavin.
Yeah.
And I just think it sort of went in my mind as executive producer freaking out anyway.
Yeah.
And I suddenly, it's back to you, Molly.
Well, I had nowhere to go. Yes. I couldn't throw to a clip or anything like that. That was his job as the host. Yeah. And
I think at the time I was EPing, I think it was Chris Noble produced and directed that show.
Right.
And fantastic show down at the Palais.
Yeah, the Palais, yeah.
St Kilda, what a backdrop for a rock and roll show.
It was
a fantastic area.
And you were walking with Billy before the show did he throw a beer bottle over?
No, we weren't going to any of that. No, he...
oh, come on, tell. You've got to tell the story
now. There were a few nefarious characters wandering in and out of his dressing room.
Oh, yeah.
No, I did catch him sort of swinging a beer bottle up and down. I think Chris was in the middle of the show and Billy had been naughty all day and he was running amok. And I think he may well have thrown it over the top of the set. It sort of landed, I believe it landed, well, it did, it sort of landed in the hallway between the executives of the record companies.
Oh, no.
We're all sitting in the front rows. A mild explosion, nothing more to worry about.
That's rock and roll.
Little few quick brush and broom pans and things to clean it up, and no one noticed. And on we went.
The heavy sex content comment was true. He just had it backstage.
No, I can't. I don't know. I don't have any. But although I do remember questioning the security guys and saying, how did those young ladies get in here? And I think the answer was something like, they told me he was family.
Yeah. And the dumb security guy goes, oh, yeah, off you go.
That was a great award show. It was really good. And Chris's, oh, wow.
Yeah.
There's quite a story I could tell you after. There was an after party.
Oh, please. I want to hear.
It was just...
I was probably passed out by this.
Look, the things about Ian that make me laugh, I suppose, it's not so much who he knows, and because we know he knows everyone.
Yeah.
But he just does some, says some strange, odd things that you just... And I remember at the after show, Steve Hands, a great... Is he still with us?
No, he's passed. Yeah.
Oh, he was and he's just the most wonderful guy. And I think on behalf of ARIA, who we are sort of in cahoots with in terms of who was the charts and all that, because we'd given up our countdown charts ourselves because it was just so much time.
Sure.
And those guys were doing it for us at the time, you know, representing the industry. And it was the true reflection of sales anyway. So, and they contributed to the awards in that sense, and we funded the awards. The cost of them and all that. So, there's a nightclub attached or nearby the Palais Theatre, and Steve organised
the Palace.
I think it was a Gadinsky venue at the time. Steve, God bless him, he organised this function, and it was great. And you know, but like all of these things, I'm not real good at sticking around too long because it sort of gets a bit, you know. Anyway, so and of course there's the after party, and then the after after party, and it sort of was quite a night of good fun and all.
Yeah,
but I think it's time for me to go, so I quietly mingle with the crowd, edging closer to the exit, and it got to a little mezzanine area. It was only a foot or so above the ground, and I got that far, and suddenly Molly appears out of the gathered pack slapping throng. Great show, Grant. What about when Gavin said, and I threw it in, you know, laugh. Anyway, I went, right, you know, and he said, it's all great. And he said, just wait here. And I go, wait here. And he says, yeah, don't move. I want you to stay here. I've got to go to the loo. And I think, oh, okay. So I think, oh, here we go. So I can't escape. I'll just wait. So I'm waiting there, and Molly heads off. Now, there are two doors. Male, quite clearly, and female. And Molly careens in through the... into the female toilets, and I'm like, well, this will be interesting. And then suddenly you hear this eruption of screaming, and above it all, it's only me, girls, lovey, don't worry, it's only, all goes quiet, everyone's happy, it's only Molly in the girls' toilet. So that's fine, and I'm thinking, oh, this will be, and of course the crowd sort of went quiet at that moment, and then it got on with the normal noise goes on with the party. Anyway, you've got to put this as sort of like in slow motion, but as Molly is exiting the toilet, walking along the mezzanine floor with arms slovenly wrapped around Steve, and it's Billy Idol.
Oh, Billy. Dear Billy.
You know, they've just done the show. And he's in full drag attire, you know, the gloves and the crosses and the blonde hair, and Steve's over there walking along. And, of course, as he's careening, he's heading towards me. At exactly that time, Molly is coming out of the women's toilet.
Right.
Okay, so now it's in slow motion. As Molly's coming out, they're advancing. And we all pull up together. And you can see Billy, he looks at Molly, he looks at me, he looks at Steve, he looks at the door that Molly's just exited, and he goes, great idea, man. And together with Steve, they head off into the ladies' toilets. And Molly goes, time to go. So we split, and all you can hear is, and the screaming starts again.
Oh, how fantastic.
No, but they're the sort of things Molly seems to be able to...
But you've got so many stories.
Yeah, well...
So many stories.
I hope I haven't offended anyone at all.
No, but I want you to tell all our listeners the story of you and Ian, Molly, in England, and you had to come back and do Prince Charles's interview. And then while you were there, you're doing a series of interviews as well. So if you could tell me, from the time you got to England, what happened?
Well, that's a long journey, a long time ago.
Yeah.
The ABC is a strange, very conservative organisation.
Sure.
And for somehow or other, you know, we're going to go on this world trip, and I'm thinking, how can I get out of this? I know it sounds silly, but travelling with Ian is an exercise in patience and tolerance.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Anyway, so, okay, I'm told I'm going. And Michael Shrimpton was executive producer, and that was the opportunity for Ted to come up as a producer-director. So he stepped out of assisting me, mm-hmm. and began, and so he ought to. I mean, it was never about me being better than him. I mean, he was just ready to go. And so he came in while I was away. That happened. He carried the show on until I got back, and then we both worked together. It was great.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, alternate weeks, and it was really good fun. And it enables to do other things as well.
Sure.
But anyway, so we did this. Michael said to me, now, you need an itinerary. And I'm thinking, yes, right, and then too. And the ABC is conservative, and, you know, you're spending taxpayer money. And so I'm thinking, an itinerary. Now, Molly hasn't organised a phone call on time in his life.
Yeah.
He does a lot of phone calls.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I sat together with the crew and we invented this minute-by-minute, three-week itinerary with appointments and talent names and all this. Complete bullshit, the whole thing, and handed it in. Hence, with a whole bunch of traveller's checks, and Molly and we and I head off.
Right.
Anyway, first thing we go to... it was a Qantas. I think it was TAA to Sydney, and then Qantas to... I can't remember.
A1 and 2?
Well, I think we went to San Francisco. I can't remember how it went, and then we end up in LA first, and we were doing a bit of stuff there at the infamous Sunset Marquee Hotel. Very
beautiful
rock and roll.
Beautiful,
it's fantastic
place.
Fun. Yeah. And, but getting at the airport, he didn't have a passport. And I said, Ian... where's your passport? In the meantime, I've been telling him on the plane he has to fill in his travel diary and expenses. He says, never going to happen, lovey. So I just spend my days filling in this another fictitious document for submission to the ABC. But I get to the airport and I'm straight away through, and there I'm waiting for Molly, who's been grabbed by officialdom and marched off.
In England?
No, this is L.A.
L.A., oh, okay.
No passport, because we went via L.A.,
America
first to do a couple of things, and then across, and then came back to America after that.
Okay.
Anyway, sure enough, a few minutes. He had a letter of some sort from,
a letter of introduction.
From somebody, I don't know, with the consulate here.
No, that was the problem, he used to lose his passport.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, I don't know, you know better than me. All I know is he never satisfactorily explained anything, but anyway, we got it.
Cut
a long story short, we ended up in England, and... by the way, on that trip, you know, that we never planned for, I think I'll give you a list of some of the artists that he got in a day.
Yeah.
In America and, you know, very in either place. Freddie Mercury, Paul McCartney, Julie Covington, Don't Cry For Me, number one in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Stevie Nicks, Rod Stewart.
Oh, my God.
It was like the who's who of the industry. And he did it in a day sitting on the phone. I just to this day, I still think back. It's just gobsmacking.
Yeah.
But anyway, cut a long story short, we were filming at Portland Place. Now, Portland Place is a very lovely part of London, and I don't know it all that well, but it was this basement and three or four stories of large terrace home. It was just with the manager for Europe of the ABC on the top floor, and then there was news, you know, Paul Murphy, the great journalist.
Yes.
He was the London... Okay. He was there. And it was just these people who serviced the ABC news... basically for all of Europe, out of London.
Mm.
The general manager, who's straight out of a Second World War movie, had a part in the middle, he had a double-breasted pinstripe suit. He was like he just got
out of... I say, chaps.
He just got out of a Lancaster bomber. You know, like he's just a classic gentleman. Anyway, he was so gracious. And out the back, they had stables from the original house, and that was the editing suites.
Right.
So we took over the courtyard area, and Molly hits the phones. Well... we've got everywhere. There's all people sitting on the steps. There's no reception area per se. Just, and we're upstairs with our feet up having coffee with Murphy and Paul and we're having a great old chat. And I'm saying, Ian, we've got all... Anyway, so eventually we get down and we start filming them. And amongst the crowd, there was Sid Vicious and from the Sex Pistols, but no Johnny Rotten, which is became a real bugbear to Ian. It was killing him that Johnny Rotten, how dare he not turn up where we tell him to. Through Malcolm McLaren, I think he's managed.
Yes, of course, yeah.
Anyway... cut a long story short, it was a fantastic success. We were shooting one after the other, and these punk bands were really aggressive, and there was a young punk band called Generation X.
Yes.
Billy Idol
was
the lead singer, and Molly immediately said, this guy's a hit. He's going to be a hit. I don't know how when he said it's just going to be huge.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, I'm listening to him. He's the expert. Anyway, so these kids... after swearing and everyone's effing this and rah, 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 they'd look and say, well, there's Julie Covington. You know, they were really just little kids, you know.
Yeah.
They were just as big of fans as everybody else.
Sure.
But as soon as the camera or anyone came, they just swear it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, come on, the general manager had been so gracious to us, he said, look, could you get me, my daughter's birthday's coming, could you get us a cup of autographs? And we're, yeah, sure, not a problem. Anyway... yes, yes, sir. And he's given us some album covers, and we're thinking, oh, God, here we go. Anyway, so we're dutifully doing that. But we just finished Billy Idol, and they were sitting around talking, and there was a slight break in between, or it may have been a tape roll, a film roll change or something.
Yeah.
And Ian says, you know, it's a bit, we really should be giving more than just a couple of artists. Why don't we introduce him to a few artists? The general manager, this is. I'm thinking, yeah, well, that sounds like a good idea, and I didn't think it through. He said, yeah, Billy. So he said, come on. So off we go, and around to the general manager's office. Now, here's a guy who's very conservative,
yes,
representing the ABC,
right,
who doesn't think Countdown is... They're still debating whether it's good for the whole organisation. And we're in London in their space.
Yeah.
Anyway, excuse me, sir. And he goes, yes, how can I help you, Grant? And I said, look, you might want to meet one of the up-and-coming star, future stars of the industry. I'd love to. And he stands up straight. He's double-breasted, Jack.
Yeah.
Stands up and puts his hand in Billy Saunders' hand. He says, how do you do, sir? And he goes, why don't you go and get a stupid old git? And puts his cigarette on his blotter. Well, Molly, I look around, his head's just vanished around the door. He's gone. So the general manager's straightening up, ready to come back at us. And I've grabbed Billy and gone.
Come on.
Yeah, Ian thought it was hilarious. You know.
But there was an altercation, wasn't there, that day?
Oh, yes, yes. That was the Johnny Rotten...
altercation.
Yes.
Yes. What
well, Ian started to... He became obsessed. Despite the fact that we've got all these superstars in my history, I could never recall anyone else getting. I thought, this guy... Look, Ian's amazing, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, so he's at Malcolm McLaren, and we're going to get a cab, and we're going to find him. We're going to track him.
You know?
So very early one morning, we head off, and Malcolm McLaren said to go here. So we go there. And then we go to a public phone box. There were no credit cards, no phones. There was and ring it. Nobody goes. And eventually, after trooping around for 4 hours, paying a cab on ABC, taxpayer money, he's in a pub in Soho. Now, what that means is that Malcolm McLaren knows he's in a pub. It doesn't necessarily... Johnny Rotten doesn't necessarily know, or Malcolm, that he's going to be doing an interview. There's a big difference between So I go, all right. So we pull up the pub and we get ourselves, and we've got the crew with us. A guy on a Niagara in those days, tape recorder.
Yeah.
And a film camera.
Yeah.
And me and Molly. And so I go into the pub and go to the governor. I track him down and say, look, you've got a celebrity at the back. We're from the ABC and I'm producing my bloody... who I am, and we've got permission, Malcolm McLaren, we're just going to film an interview at the back. Would you mind? It could be publicity for the pub.
Yeah.
And he goes, I don't know trouble, but, you know, he gives me this direct warning. I'm a hand a few readies over, taxpayer money.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we start, I think he went down his coffee. Anyway, so we start making our way through the crowd. Now, the whole idea is that we're going to get into him, and Molly says, whatever happens, Grant, don't stop filming.
All right.
I went, odd suggestion. Okay, but the whole stuff to get, you know, I ignored it, you know. Odd suggestion. Don't stop. And then he adds, even if he chucks me through a window. And I think, again, an odd suggestion. Well, okay, we get on with it. So we get in and we hustle and bustle. We've got the cameraman there and I've got their Niagara. And, you know, they hand me the sun gun. Now, to those who don't know what a sun gun is, it's a little portable light. It's so big, like, you know, the size of a
powerful.
Big battery.
Very
you turn it on in a dark and candle-lit room, which it was. Oh, I forgot to mention that London was experiencing four-hourly blackouts. So it just so happens that Soho is in blackout, and the pub's lit by candles. So now it's dark, nefarious, with a lot of Cockney accents, and a very seedy area of London. And we're heading through a darkened area, crowds buffeting, into the corner. And there's these nibs, Johnny Rotten, sitting at the coffee table with his minions. They've all got safety pins through their faces and razor blades on chains. You know, I was just terrified. Anyway, the plan is this. I'll say, act, blah, 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 action, sound, right to go. And action, and I turn the light on. So we're already ready to go, and we're whispering. And I'm not sure why we're whispering. Like, it's a crowded pub, and it's bloody buffeting going on.
Yeah.
So, okay, and action. And I turn the light on. Well, as you can imagine, in a candlelit
Like rabbits.
Pub,
rabbits.
It's like an atomic bomb goes off. And then I'm in a stunned moment, and Molly is bounding up, elbowing people out of the way and bounding over the coffee table and launching, and lands in Johnny Rotten's hat. Why won't you speak to me? Really aggressively.
Yeah.
And I think, did he just throw a left? I'm sure. And I'm thinking, all of my brain goes, Countdown headline, Countdown crew runs amok in Soho. Well, I switched the light off. He's never forgiven me to this day. The 30 seconds of film, now that's a treasure.
Yeah.
I don't know where that is.
Wow.
Gavin Wood's Countdown podcast was thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.